This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Friday afternoon, August 1st. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. We'll talk about the jobs report for the month of July. Job growth stumbled last month with 73,000 jobs added. That's well below expectations, while previous months saw sharp downward revisions. Joining us in the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding your business to bring your business home, is Gus Fauché, Chief Economist, PNC Financial Services in Pittsburgh. 73,000 jobs in July. The numbers in prior months revised much lower. What does this mean for the labor market, which has been fairly robust, not only through inflation, but a steep Fed interest rate hiking cycle?
That's right. I mean, we've seen job growth over the last 3 months only averaging about 35,000. With big downward revisions to May and June, the job market does not look nearly as good as we thought it did just a few days ago.
Economists are saying this is a sign that the labor market is deteriorating. Is it deteriorating in your judgment?
It certainly looks like it to me. I think that, you know, job growth at this anemic level is not enough to keep up with underlying growth in the labor force. We're likely to see the unemployment rate move higher over the next few months. And this could be an indication that the overall economy is softening in mid-2025 and does not bode well for the second half of this year.
What are some of the underlying reasons behind the job market just seemingly slowing down? We haven't seen substantial layoffs, but it just seems like businesses aren't hiring.
That's right. Hiring activity is very low. I think businesses have turned cautious. We continue to see job losses in manufacturing. So we've seen job losses for three straight months there. We're seeing job losses in business and professional services. So that covers a wide variety of things like accounting firms, law firms, temporary help, and so forth. And then most of the job growth is coming in education and healthcare, which is good, but that's not sustainable over the long run to have two-thirds of job growth coming from one industry.
Is this tariff-related uncertainty? I mean, earlier in the week, we had the inflation report, the PCE number, and we were talking about whether or not tariffs were showing up in prices that people were paying at stores for goods. But is this? But there's also been a great deal of discussion about uncertainty since April. You can't really make business investment based on tariff numbers that continue to change, threats that are made and then withdrawn. And if that uncertain environment continues, will this job market continue to be locked up?
I think there is some of that tariff uncertainty that's showing up in the numbers. Manufacturing continues to look weak. The ISM manufacturing index has been in contraction for 5 months now. I think a lot of that is tariff related. We're seeing a slower growth in consumer spending. I think people are more anxious about buying big ticket items because they're unsure of where the economy is going to go. And I think all of this is a drag on the labor market.
If the Fed decides to cut interest rates by a quarter point in September and maybe another quarter point later in the year, is that enough to cure that bout of tariff-related uncertainty?
I think it's going to be difficult. I think that the tariffs and the uncertainty that's surrounding them is going to be a significant drag on the economy, and it may take the Fed to be more aggressive to ward off a recession later this year or in early 2026.
Gus Fauché, Chief Economist, PNC Financial Services in Pittsburgh, thank you for joining us today. Coming up on the Noon Business Hour, another Chicago food favorite has gone national.
Cash, credit, debit, and totally free. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Chicago's iconic Rainbow Cone continues its national expansion, transforming a Southside favorite into a beloved brand enjoyed across America. We welcome in Lynn Sapp, member of the original family behind the original Rainbow Cone, which is about to celebrate its 100th anniversary next year. Lynn, thank you for joining us today. And I grew up in the Beverly neighborhood, Lynn, and so to me, Rainbow Cone was the place that you went after summer soccer at Dan Ryan Woods. But not too long ago, I found myself in Mount Prospect, and we were in the mood for ice cream. and there was Rainbow Cone. And that seemed unthinkable to me. You meant just not too long ago that you could get a Rainbow Cone in the Northwest suburbs.
That's where we're growing. We're growing. And I'm very grateful. So everybody's like, what took you so long? 100 years?
you needed some time to see if the idea actually traveled.
Well, yes, and a team to do it with. That was the key, too, where the Bonavolato family comes in. So do you believe we're in 6 states now?
That's the question, is that there are a number of brands that were local favorites that have expanded, and every now and then that story of expansion is also that's when the headaches begin. But how has this expansion been for Rainbow Cone? Is this a concept that does travel well beyond 92nd and Western?
Well, it does, and that's why I did Taste of Chicago, because people had never been to 92nd and Western. They did not know, they don't have the stories like you do, Rob. They've just saw the cone. So we proved that for several past 20 years at Taste of Chicago, kind of did a test marketing, you know. And, of course, there's going to be bumps. And explaining to people, like down at Lollapalooza right now, that yes, all those 5 flavors go and it really tastes good all together and it's fantastic. And conveying that is part of the challenge, because they've never seen anything like it. They have no idea what you're talking about. What do you mean 5 slices on a cone, you know? So once we get the great marketing team getting that out, my role now is a historian and to explain how great the cone is. So... which I'm grateful.
Now, when we had a member of the Bona Beef family on about a month ago talking about the success of Rainbow Cone as it's moved out of the South Side, and the one thing that he told us was that, and this was something you probably couldn't imagine in 1926, but that Rainbow Cones are Instagrammable. They look very good on social media. So even if you don't know anything about the South Side of Chicago, you see this Rainbow Cone, it's eye-catching, and you want to take a picture of it.
Well, that's the beauty of it. And to your point, the younger generation takes pictures of everything. My grandfather, Joe, started the company, was a photographer, and he would have never imagined how it's all over the, you know, phones and the internet. And that's Bonavolato's strength, because the younger generation is like, everybody takes a picture of it. You hand them that cone, they take a picture of it. And it's so true.
Now, as the historian of original Rainbow Cone now, this was a question I had. This was an idea that popped into my head the moment we discovered that the new Pope was a Southside and South Suburban native. And I said, I think for the first time in the history of the Catholic Church, we have a Pope that actually has been to Rainbow Cone. Now, have you done some sleuthing, and have you figured out whether or not Father Robert Prevost went to Rainbow Cone on the way to St. Rita some afternoon?
Well, you know how Chicago is, and you know how the South Side is, Rob. You know, you do know somebody who knows them. And my cousin's brother used to, was an altar boy with him. And so I'm like, hey, Kathy, you know, do you think he went to Rainbow? We can't confirm, but we don't know. So he did go to Rita. My father went to Rita. My brothers went to St. Rita. So there is all these 6 degrees of separation, and we're hoping, but I can't actually say that that's true.
But Lynn, my goal is to stay in this business long enough to get the chance to interview the pontiff. And I think my first 2 questions to him will be, A, have you been to Rainbow Cone? And B, have you been to Top Notch? Because this has been like, I've been obsessed with this idea ever since May 8th.
Right. Yes, who knows?
You get 2 Southsiders on the phone. You can't help but talk about the old neighborhood. Lynn Sapp, member of the family behind the original Rainbow Cone in Chicago, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. Coming up next, a proposed major railroad merger would have a major impact on Chicago.
Cashing in with conversation, the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Chicago sits at the heart of a proposed coast-to-coast rail merger poised to gain from streamlined airline freight, but also at risk of losing jobs, yards, and shipping volume in the process. We welcome in Jason Hilsenbeck, owner of LoadMatch.com and chairman of the Intermodal Association of Chicago. Jason, thank you for joining us today. And this proposed merger of Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern that was announced this week would eliminate what has been a geographical barrier for the railroad industry for nearly 200 years. That is, you cannot ship a car coast to coast on a single line. You have to hand off from a West Coast railroad to an East Coast railroad in Chicago. This merger would eliminate that handoff. And what does this mean for logistics in the Chicago area if the feds give their blessing to this combination?
Hi, Rob. Well, it's one misconception is that there's, you know, there is transcontinental service right now. And the thing that I like to impress upon is that there's not going to be new tracks built to change how this system works. So the service that you're getting now is still going to go through Chicago on rail car and intermodal container. The intermodal container segment is what really I think the public in Chicagoland should have focused on, and I'd love to go over that.
Well, I would say if you're, you know, driving around and maybe you're stuck at a railroad crossing or you see a train passing you and you see hundreds of flat cars with two containers each, and you might wonder where are they coming from and where are they going? And what would this do to that container traffic that you see coming through the city?
The main thing is actually on the highway. There's about 15 major intermodal container yards in Chicago, various railroads, all the class ones, the two Canadian railroads, the four American U.S. railroads. And they're all spread out from Joliet to Bensonville to Harvey, downtown Chicago. And what this merger means is that the intermodal container trains from the Union Pacific that get transferred to the Norfolk Southern, sometimes they put them on the train and go through Chicago on the railroad track. Sometimes they take the containers off and they shuttle the containers on the highway or the roads to get to the next railroad. So this is what the merger can mean. There'd be more steel wheel train through trains going from Union Pacific to Norfolk Southern. And because right now there's about 2,500 trucks a day that shuttle containers between the rail yards in Chicago. So there's a lot of congestion that happens because of trucks shuttling containers.
Now, very quickly, Jason, you've been around the business for a long time. In your estimation, do you think this UPNS merger actually happens?
I think it will. I think that with the current climate and the government and the only way to grow rail car, intermodal and rail car business is to merge. And the jobs in Chicago should be okay. You know, it's the management jobs, I think, that we consolidated. So I think the workers that are, you know, 20,000 drivers doing drayage, the drayage trucking, that stays the same. But yes, I think this will happen.
Jason Hilsenbeck, owner of LoadMatch.com, chairman of the Intermodal Association of Chicago. Thank you for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. Still ahead in Entrepreneur Friday, a growing Chicago business that's expanding from charcuterie boards to the grill.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. The markets are lower. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Art Hogan, Chief Market Strategist, B. Riley Financial in New York. Art, thank you for joining us today. And I hesitated there for just a second because I wanted to read the numbers, but maybe it would just bring everybody down on a summer Friday afternoon.
Yeah, there's no sense in really dwelling on that. Let's think about happy things like the Red Sox and how many games they've won in the last 10. I think that's probably better news to report.
Hey, my White Sox are hot, too. So, all is good in the land of teams named after clothing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we're having a soft Friday. I would tell you there's three main drivers, and none of them are really positive. I think that, first and foremost, we got a jobs report that came out worse than expected. Estimates were for about 110,000 jobs have been created, and only 73,000 were. But if that's not bad enough, the last 2 months were revised lower, significantly lower. So coming into this report today, the three-month average jobs creation was about 150,000 jobs a month. And now after the revisions in today's report, it's down to 37,000 jobs a month. So that's a troubling sign for the labor market. At the same time, yesterday, we got a personal consumption expenditure, PCE, the Fed's favored inflation gauge, and that was a bit hotter than expected. So we've got a bad combination of slowing economic growth as it relates to the labor and sticky inflation. And all of this kind of points to the adverse effects that a lot of investors have been waiting to see in the hard data because of trade and tariffs.
Is this a stagflationary environment? And if that is the case, what can the Fed do about it?
Well, I would tell you this, yes and no. So it's in general, if you look at the longer term averages, the unemployment has only moved up to 4.2%. So that's not worrisome. But the slowdown in growth, if it continues with uncertainty around the end game of this trade war, would certainly get us closer to that environment. I would say that what the central bank will do, that FOMC will do, likely is look at the increase in prices as a one-time event. Goods prices are clearly going to be higher this year because of tariffs. And they'll assume that that's a one-time event that monetary policy doesn't have much impact on. And they will react to their other mandate, which is full employment. And I suspect by the time the data rolls through for the September meeting, that'll be the first time they get a chance to react to that. And they'll likely cut rates at that meeting and probably again at the October meeting and again at the December meeting. So it's not permanent inflation necessarily, because you're raising prices on a one-time basis. The Fed likely looks through that and starts reacting to the softness in the labor market.
And it seems like the numbers are starting to catch up with the anecdata out there, is that this is a slow to hire and slow to fire labor market. But is it teetering on a point where layoffs will start picking up?
Well, they haven't. That's a really good point, Rob. So the weekly jobless claims have been very steady at the sort of 215 to 220,000 level. And that's good news. So we haven't seen massive layoffs. If that starts to kick in, then you're going to see much more weakness in the labor market. So that's been one of the positives, the hoarding of employees, but not new hires, right? So you're not letting a lot of people go, but you're not creating new jobs. And that can rectify itself. If both those things start to happen, and then this weakens even further, and we start to get to a place where some of the non-farm payroll numbers are negative numbers, then you're talking about serious weakness, and you see much more of a drastic reaction by the Federal Reserve.
Art Hogan, Chief Market Strategist, B. Riley Financial in New York. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Entrepreneur Friday, a business that began on a charcuterie board is now moving to the grill.
Money conversation that pays a big dividend. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Hey, it's Entrepreneur Friday, and after spending years in the corporate America grind, a woman from Chicago has turned her passion for food and entertaining into a national brand. We welcome in Babs Beitzel, founder of Babs Board in Chicago. Babs, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And the one thing...
Thanks so much for having me. Nice to talk to you, Rob.
Well, I was going to say, the one thing I've really noticed in talking to entrepreneurs is that you reach a point of time in your life, in your career, and you say, that's it? That's all there is? And I want to do something else. So what was your that's it moment in corporate America? And how much time did it take you to get this business off the ground?
Right. No offense to people who are in accounting and finance, but this is way more fun, I have to be honest. I retired for about 3 months, and then I was a little bit bored. So I started Babs Boards back in 2021.
And in 2021, this began as a charcuterie exercise. And when did you make the turn from actually making the boards to getting into the educational side of cooking?
Right. So I was doing charcuterie boards for probably 6 months, and then someone approached me and asked if I taught charcuterie classes. I had never taught anything a day in my life. I'm an accountant, right? But I gave it a stab and found out that that's truly my passion. I love teaching. So 250 charcuterie classes and then Girls Who Grill classes I've taught later. Here I am, and I really have found my love.
And what was the inspiration for Girls Who Grill? Because I know, you know, barbecue, right, and it's dad behind the grill all the time.
Yeah,
it's not mom behind the grill.
No.
So when did you say, like, this could be for you too?
I'm hoping to change that, right? It's predominantly, you know, dominated by men. I'm the griller in my house, so I always found my friends coming over for dinner parties, and they were wondering why they weren't learning how to do that. So once the charcuterie classes kind of took off, I thought, hey, I could teach girls how to grill, too. Why not? And it's been a big hit.
Now, I feel like when it comes to grilling, everyone thinks they're good at it just because you can slap some hamburgers on the grill, or maybe you could do a steak or some chicken. But when you really want to level up your grill game, what's your first tip?
Oh, I love that question. So my first tip is really to take the entire meal outside to the grill. So it's just not the meat, in my opinion. I do the appetizers, anywhere from grilled bread for bruschetta, grilled veggies with burrata, you know, the main course, obviously, all the sides. Why heat up the kitchen when you're out using the grill, right? I do the desserts on the grill, which I think really kind of amazes everybody that you could grill desserts. But I don't heat up my kitchen in the summer. It's all outside.
And then when you decided to go into business for yourself, when you began making the charcuterie boards, did you ever imagine that it would end up here a mere 4 years later?
No, never. Never in a million years. I mean, I really pretty much started it on a whim and wasn't even sure charcuterie boards would take off. And the fact that I'm talking to you today, I mean, this is just a dream come true. I'm doing what I love, which is cooking, grilling, entertaining, having dinner parties all the time, and sharing it with as many people as I can. It's just been a dream come true. I love it all.
Well, you love it. And what is the win for you? I mean, is it the fact that you have developed a business that can sustain itself? Or is it just, you know, meeting people and passing along your love of this craft to other people?
Yeah, I mean, it's really the teaching component where somebody leaves and from one of my Girls Who Grill classes and tells me in an email later that I've really changed her life, the way she cooks and grills for her family. She's able to do this now. She's, you know, using tips and tricks that she learned from me. I mean, that just makes my day. I know this isn't, you know, curing diseases or anything, but if I could make somebody's life a little bit easier with some of my classes, that just brings me so much joy. That is why I'm doing this.
Now, lastly, and this is a question that has been rattling around in my head for a very long time. And I'm glad we have a charcuterie expert here so I can finally get an official ruling. And that is as follows. Babs, do Lunchables count as charcuterie?
No. I've heard that joke, right? No, it does not count. I use, you know, the best quality meats and cheeses. No offense to Lunchables. I hope they're not a sponsor of the show, but no, it does not count.
Well, now we have an official ruling, Babs. Thank you for settling this debate once and for all. Babs Beitzel, founder of Babs Boards in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. Still to come, an update on the brewing industry as we mark International Beer Day.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's International Beer Day, and today we're tapping into a shifting industry during a time that remains to be beer's strongest season, which is summer. We welcome in Carly Katz, owner of Bottles and Cans, several locations in Chicago. Carly, thank you for joining us today. And as the song says, it's 12:50 somewhere.
That works for me. And on a Friday, why not?
Now, it's one of the big issues facing the beer industry. One, I would imagine, is cyclical tastes, because IPAs and craft beers and different types of flavor profiles really took off in the last 20 years or so. But now younger drinkers are going back to the tried and true, and one might say the cheaper stuff. I mean, you have kids today who are getting Hams or Miller Lite or just the stuff that craft beer was designed to pull you away from.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's almost as if there was like a reset with this younger generation. Like, they're almost starting from the beginning with like what we kind of joke is like beer flavored beer. And that seems to be so consistent, especially this summer that we've seen. I mean, Pilsner's lagers, like that Coors Light, you know, drink it if the mountains are blue theme is kind of everywhere right now, which is great in general because we get to see a new generation kind of start over and see that path like build up again. But for the craft beer movement, it's it's they're trying to pivot and get back to that. Like, we're seeing them kind of create more lagers, easy drinking pilsners, just kind of what everyone is looking for, but also going back to like the roots of it all.
And it also seems like, talking to some craft brewers, they say that legalized recreational marijuana is skimming the foam off of their sails, that that's a whole new category of competition that just didn't exist a couple of years ago.
It really is. And, you know, that's kind of a whether they're doing it because the alcohol trend was kind of put on pause for a lot of those college students that are now like your everyday drinker. During COVID, they just weren't drinking. And so these other things started to kind of come out of the woodwork for them, which is why we are seeing a lot more of those THC, CBD drinks. A lot of the brewers, though, you're going to see them making their own. You know, they have the equipment, they have the abilities, and now you're going to see them kind of marketing towards that same THC group and creating their own. So you go into these tap rooms or you come into a bottles and cans, and your options are now, I love this beer from this brewery, but oh, look, this brewery is also making a THC beverage. And hopefully that is kind of dealing with that spread and that area where they're losing a little bit of that profitability, but they're making it up in other ways.
The market always adapts. Carly Katz, owner of Bottles and Cans in Chicago, thank you for joining us on this International Beer Day.